Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. So today we are recording a podcast on stroke. And we are really lucky to have a stroke specialist with us, Dr. Brendan Black, and I'll let him introduce himself in a moment. And I've also got an old favourite of mine, not so old, Peter, who's going to be doing the podcast with us. And stroke, really important. Obviously, we see it a lot. I think we've just been reflecting before recording this that we're actually managing them a little bit more now as well. So when I first started as a registrar, I just didn't really see them. The stroke nurses came down, whisked them up to the stroke ward, whether or not they needed thrombolysis. And there you go. We didn't really see them. So the fact that actually I'm getting a bit more involved with the basic management has left me feeling a little bit insecure. So Brendan's going to sort that out for me today. And then also, obviously, for our medical registrars in acute internal medicine, this can be a dual accreditation. So another reason to do a podcast on stroke. So Brendan, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hello. So I'm Brendan Black. I'm currently ST7 in geriatric medicine, but I've completed a stroke fellowship last year, about 18 months ago. So I've taken quite an interest in stroke and I'm sub-specializing in that. So working towards my CCT currently, with the hope of working as a stroke consultant in the not so distant future.
But Peter, everybody knows you. So yeah. Do you want to just say hi?
Hello, everybody. It's just me again.
So let's start. Peter, I'll let you have the first question for Brendan.
Thanks, Vicky. So Brendan, quite like Vicky, I feel like I'm very much de-skilled in managing stroke. And I'm not entirely sure I'm doing all the right things. So when you get a referral to come see one of our patients who we think has a stroke, what annoys you the most? What have we done wrong? Can we do better?
Thank you. So the answer to that, nothing, of course. Everything's always done perfectly.
That's just because it's Peter.
However, I suppose there's a few things that we probably would point out. And I suppose we check ourselves on them as well frequently. I suppose the first thing, which is really important in context of stroke, is VTE. Patients after a stroke, particularly disabling stroke, are at increased risk of DVT and PE, which would significantly increase mortality. Obviously, we've got a difficulty here when they've got an acute infarct because we can't use our typical chemical thromboprophylaxis because of the increased risk of hemorrhagic transformation. But we do use, for patients who are immobile, they should be prescribed intermittent pneumatic compression stockings. And these are validated for up to 4 weeks or until they're mobile. The thing we do see is patients with TED stockings. So the first thing you should do, if you do anything, is take the TED stockings off because there's no evidence that they're going to help. But after 4 weeks, generally patients then at that point can be considered then for low molecular weight heparin. Increasingly, we're doing it earlier and we're starting to see now that low molecular weight heparin and it's been started sort of around the sort of 2 week mark. But it's sort of on a case-by-case basis at the moment. But so that would be the first thing. Second thing is aspirin. So patients with ischemic stroke at some point prescribed aspirin 300 milligrams, and that's historically for 14 days. But what I would say is it's 14 days or until day of discharge, whichever comes first. And the reason I'd emphasize it is because patients get confused. So if you send somebody home with aspirin 300 and what we would switch them to, which is clopidogrel 75 milligrams once a day, they end up taking both or thinking, should I still be taking aspirin a bit further? So we often encourage patients to, we encourage people to, when they're discharging patients, just switch them over to their secondary prevention. So which is commonly clopidogrel 75 milligrams, unless contraindicated. What else? So all patients should have an ECG. I think we're quite good at doing that anyway. When patients come into A&E, they all get one. The main reason is to look for atrial fibrillation, because if we see that, it will impact our management in that we're not going to use clopidogrel, we're going to use anticoagulation probably.
Oh, can I just stop there?
Sure.
So you said on day discharge, we switched to clopidogrel. So what if we see somebody who's had a relatively small stroke, we can discharge them fairly early. They were on aspirin 300, but we've diagnosed new AF.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, do you switch to straight away to warfarin, or on those patients do you, or DOAC or whatever, or on those patients do you wait for 2 weeks?
Yeah. So more recently, so I think it's the European Society of Cardiology had released some guidance on this. Off the top of my head, I can't remember all the criteria, mm-hmm. but there's a good table online.
Which we can put in our lovely show notes.
Which we'll do. Yeah. We'll add that at the end. But there have been trials into this, and it's so we're finding, you know, patients who have had a fairly mild stroke, and we would class that sort of as an NIHSS score of less than 8, which is the stroke severity scale. You can start oral anticoagulation earlier. So I think it's somewhere around day 5 you can actually start. But at the moment, in the hospital we work in, it's stroke consultant decision only at the moment. Right. So it's not in routine practice, but we can do that. If you're worried, if it's very large infarct, I doubt there would be discharge before the 14 days. It would just be continuing the aspirin.
How bad those bed pressures get
printed. It does. And you never know what will come. Yeah. We'd be ambulating these people in AC.
Yeah.
But there's more and more evidence coming out. We can actually switch them earlier with relative safety. But if in doubt, just ask.
So that segues me into a point about anticoagulation. Mm-hmm. So if people come and they're on warfarin, mm-hmm. I think I know what to do, but what if their INR's 8? And this is just, I think for simplicity's sake, mm-hmm. just ischemic stroke. So, because obviously it's very different if it's a hemorrhagic stroke, but let's say that INR's actually high.
Okay.
What do you do? So two questions really. What do you do generally? And then what if their INR's high?
Fine. So generally, we're actually seeing less and less warfarin, which is a good thing. But if it's generally what we would do, patients with acute ischemic stroke, first instance, if it was a reasonably normal INR, we would just stop the warfarin and start aspirin. I think if someone's presenting with an INR of 8, I think that probably does pose an increased risk of hemorrhagic transformation. Mm. You know, you're getting into quite dangerous territory. I think I'd be tempted to reverse it with vitamin K, first of all, and then give aspirin. You can give, there actually isn't a huge rush in the aspirin. Yeah. So aspirin should be given as soon as possible, but within 24 hours. So you've got a bit of time, you know, if you wanted to reverse that and recheck the INR and, you know, provide it with relative safety. So I think that would probably be the approach I would take. Different again, if it's somebody with who thinking about thrombolizing. I mean, obviously there'd be contraindicated for thrombolysis because the INR is 8. But again, we can do point of care testing in the departments. You can get an INR back within a few minutes, really.
Yeah.
And then obviously bleed. That's another kettle of fish completely, where you would rapidly reverse.
So if you've got somebody on warfarin who you think might be a thrombolysis candidate, you would consider that as long as they're not over anticoagulated. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So if a patient's on warfarin and they've presented within a thrombolysis window, you can thrombolize them if their INR is, their point of care INR is 1.7 or less.
Okay, very precise.
Mm, isn't it?
Trial doing that was.
So what do you do with the DOACs then? Because we obviously don't measure the level of the DOACs.
No. DOACs, it's a bit more unfortunate. So I think the key thing is to get a really accurate history from, if you can, from the patient, but often there's speech disturbance and even cognitive disturbance. But from next of kin, you know, when was the last dose taken? I think it's slightly different for each DOAC. I usually have to look it up at each time. But generally, if they've had a DOAC, if they've taken a DOAC within the last 48 hours, then thrombolysis is contraindicated.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you think that will change?
It might do. There has been a few cases of that I've read about where people are using the antidotes for DOACs to rapidly reverse them and then thrombolize. But at the moment, as far as I'm aware, the guidelines do not support that.
Sure. Okay.
But who knows? Who knows?
So if someone's on warfarin or DOAC and the INR is normal, you don't think that they're super therapeutic or toxic with them, you just stop and start aspirin straight away?
Yeah. Just stop taking it and start aspirin immediately. I wouldn't reverse. I think just in the context of the INR being 8, it would give you, I think it would worry us even out of stroke, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
A bit,
and then
a bit
in
twitchy.
Between, there's a bit of clinical acumen, really.
Yeah.
Isn't
yeah. yeah. And then all you'd need is, you know, patients with big stroke, then at risk of aspiration, and they could start on antibiotics, and that INR creeps up even further.
Yeah.
So they're all the catastrophizing I've been doing in my head.
Yeah. So go on then, you were beautifully going through all the things and then we interrupted you.
Yeah, so what else have we got? So swallow screening. So all of our brilliant stroke specialist nurses will assess every patient with a stroke and assess their swallowing to ensure, because obviously that can be impaired. Mm. Unfortunately, we as doctors are very bad at attending training courses for that, so even myself. So often what we have to do, if you haven't got anybody trained to assess the swallow, assume it's unsafe and put them nil by mouth and refer to speech and language to assess as soon as possible. The only other bugbear would be carotid Dopplers. So we see a lot of carotid Dopplers being done. My favourite's always when it's a posterior circulation yeah. stroke, and I do wonder what we're looking for. And then the challenge arises when you actually find a 95% stenosis in the right ICA, but it's a posterior
yeah.
stroke,
yeah.
Which is, you know, so I think carotid Dopplers, I always say it has to be an anterior circulation stroke.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. If you're not sure, it's okay to hold off until you get an MRI
mm-hmm.
for a bit more evidence and then do it. It has to be done fairly quickly, to be fair.
Like yeah. How quickly do you have to operate this?
So it's all a bit dependent, but the vascular surgeons tend to operate within a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the longer the time goes on, the lower the benefit. And we can actually do, they'll actually do the carotid Dopplers up as far as 6 months, I believe.
Okay.
I've never known it to happen mm-hmm. myself.
Yeah.
But beyond 6 months, then the evidence isn't there. So actually, if somebody presented really late after a stroke,
yeah,
which I have had.
Yeah, I've had this recently.
Yeah.
And I felt like an idiot because I asked for carotid Dopplers.
I think.
But it was like a barn door anterior stroke.
Yeah.
And then in hindsight, he probably wouldn't have had an operation anyway. And I felt bad because I'm always teaching my juniors, don't order the test if you're not going to do anything with the answer. And so there was two reasons why I probably shouldn't have done it. But I just went, oh, he's had a stroke, I'll get across. But this just shows it's this level of sort of de-skilling a bit, really, isn't it?
I mean, to be fair, I'm a bit, I can always see the other side of it. I know there's some, you know, stroke consultants who are very strict on it. But I think it's nice for the patient sometimes to know, and us, to know why did the stroke happen. And you can sort of help them plan for the future. Maybe that's a little bit more of the geriatric side coming out.
Yeah.
But it's nice to know the cause.
Yeah.
Because if the carotids are completely normal, then it was probably something else, wasn't it? Carotid Dopplers, anterior circulation strokes, do them as soon as you can.
Mm-hmm.
They're quite good in most places I've worked. They'll usually do them the next day. But there's a few things. So when doing them, the first thing I always ask the patient is, if you were offered a surgery, which is a preventative surgery, by the way, and it takes many, many months actually for the benefit to be seen in terms of risk reduction for stroke. So would you be willing to have a major preventative surgery?
Yeah, I still remember my ITU days.
Yeah.
It's not a small op, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. And some people can be quite sick after it. And and of course, the procedure itself can cause a stroke.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll come across a patient who'll say, absolutely not, under no circumstances of my time of life when I'm having the surgery. In that case, there's no point doing it, really, is there? Because we're not, unless it's just for information purpose. So that'd be the first thing. Would the patient be agreeable? The second would be their functional status, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to prevent a severely disabling event from happening.
Yeah.
So if a patient has presented with attacks and they have a dense hemiplegia,
for completeness sake, what is TACS?
Attacks. Oh, a total anterior circulation stroke.
Yeah.
So arguably one of the most devastating forms. And sadly, one of the more common that we see. But if they have presented with that level of impairment from their stroke, the argument is the damage is done.
Okay.
So if, unless they make a good recovery in the coming weeks, there's probably no point in pursuing a surgery it's not going to prevent what's already happened. And the other thing, it would be their functional status at baseline anyway. So, you know, if they've got a life-limiting illness, as in, you know, in the next few months or whatever, then they're unlikely to get benefit from it. There is, again, it's very open to opinion. So some people will say, okay, this patient's presented with quite a disabling, you know, limb weakness. And yes, they are now requiring assistance to mobilize, but they can speak properly and they can swallow. So if they had a further stroke and they lost their ability to speak, that's a quality of life issue. Or they can't eat and drink, then that's, again, a quality of life measure. So they're not straightforward.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But I think if in doubt, hold off for, you know, temporarily and then revisit it, really.
Yeah.
Can I ask about, talking about what to do with results, what is the significant stenosis on the carotid Doppler?
So there are two guidelines. One is the European guidelines, and then the other is the NASCAT, which I believe is the American one. And we followed that. So we said that if anything greater than 50%, we will look into, basically. So if it's less than 50%, then we will, it's classed as non-symptomatic. It's unlikely to be symptomatic. So above 50%, then we'll go and we'll get a CT angiogram done at that point, because you need two modalities of imaging. So the carotid Doppler looks at velocities and then and can also characterize plaques as well, because some other things that are high risk is like an ulcerated plaque. If you see that, that's a bit more high risk, really. So some of those features are useful. And then CT angiogram, which helps sort of confirm the stenosis and also helps preoperatively, I believe, because you can look down the rest of the neck and see what the vessels are like.
Sure.
But yeah, above that, that would be, we would refer all those patients then to carotid MDT, which is led by the vascular surgeons. And then a sort of a joint consensus decision comes as to whether or not a surgery should be offered.
Okay, so that's for symptomatic carotid stenosis.
Symptomatic.
So I've come across asymptomatic carotid stenosis, and so it's a bit of an ethical dilemma. But so, what do you do with those?
So yeah, it is. It's a difficult one. So asymptomatic stenosis, for the most part, they would not go on to have a surgery, because I believe the benefit hasn't been seen in those patients in terms of risk reduction for stroke, because you don't know that that's going to go on and cause a problem.
Sure.
You know, it could remain quite stable. Mm. If I remember rightly, it's a long time from I've looked at this, I think there was a small subset of patients who did get benefit from managing. And I think it was men between the ages of 60 and 70.
Right, okay.
I think there's that small subset. Yeah. I'd have to double check that. But
show notes,
that was
team.
It.
Show notes.
I'll double check that one. But yeah, by and large. But I think if the thing is, my question would be, is how do we find it?
Mm.
How would we see, you know, somebody's had to request an ultrasound carotid Doppler.
Yeah.
So my question is, why did you request it? There might be something more to the history, really. It's not often somebody just roguely goes and does one. And unless you have, have you? Is that what you're talking
about? No,
it's normally me. Peter never admits to me.
Someone comes in with an anterior stroke, you do a carotid Doppler, and the stenosis is on the other side.
I see.
Oh, yeah. That old chestnut.
So that,
honest.
That can be quite an interesting one, actually, because say if you have somebody who's coming with pure aphasia and they're right-handed. Well, what we're saying there, probably their speech centers are in their left hemisphere.
Yeah.
What if they've got a right ICA stenosis, but the left's clear?
Yeah.
How do you know they're not in that small
percentage of people
whose speech centers are on the ipsilateral side? So that is an indication for an MRI, because an MRI might help you there. Sometimes it doesn't, comes back normal. and then, because it's such a small infarct, so sometimes it can be missed on it. But those patients we would refer to carotid MDT because we would say, you know, there is a good going stenosis on this side. What do you think?
And
then we put it to the crowd and then
okay.
I make a decision on that. So
anything else you want to tell us about your bugbears? Or
I think that's about it. Let me see.
So I've got a bugbear, I think, from, and this goes back to being a med reg. And it'd be great to get your expertise on this. So you're a med reg on call and you get bleeped to the ward. And they've got a blood pressure of 200 systolic and they've had a stroke. Help.
Okay.
What do you suggest?
So which type of stroke have they had?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So let's go ischemic.
Ischemic.
Yeah.
So This is ischemic, is the one that's a bit more difficult because there's two schools of thought on it, and it depends which specialists you're with in terms, because one will say that if you've got an ischemic stroke, you've got an occlusion of a vessel. And so your body's natural response is to raise your blood pressure in order to provide perfusion. Yeah. So there will be some consultants who will say, if it's less than 200, that's fine for 24 hours, and then we'll review it. There are others who will say, no, we need to reduce it. But the general, the evidence out there is that you would not want to lower it too much. Okay. So anything sort of less than 180, we're generally happy with. And that's the where it sort of comes into, if you look at the thrombolysis guidelines, I think that's where that arbitrary numbers come from. So that we reduce the blood pressure rapidly to less than 180 over 110 before we would thrombolyze. So that's where I sort of sit on it, just because that's a number that sticks in my head. If it's a bleed, then it's a completely different story. So bleed, if they present within 6 hours of the symptom onset, then you want to rapidly lower blood pressure, and you want to get it down to less than 140 over 90, or less than 140 systolic, I'll just say, because people get a bit hung up then on the diastolic. So it's just less than 140 systolic, and you do that IV. So either first line in our trust is labetalol, second line is GTN. Sometimes you need both together. And you maintain that at that level up to 7 days, really. You want to keep it, you keep it low. If they present beyond 6 hours, which sometimes happens, then the evidence isn't as good for lowering the blood pressure that low. So in those circumstances, we don't lower it as aggressively, unless it's sitting way over 200. I think it's 220 is actually the guidelines say, but I think most of us wouldn't be comfortable with it sitting above 200. We'd still try and take it down at least to less than 160, I think, in that circumstance.
But for an ischemic stroke that we're not going to thrombolize, who's well, whose blood pressure is about 200, sit on it.
You can, I think
Or if you're going to do anything, it'll be oral.
You can breathe. You're not in a sort of, you're not in a, this needs to be plummeted right now. And in fact, I think plummeting the blood pressure may cause more harm than good, really. The only thing, I suppose, is the theoretical risk of hemorrhagic transformation, isn't it? So if they've got a very large infarct and they're sitting with a very high blood pressure, those friable vessels that have infarcted could rupture, couldn't they, and bleed. So I think I would keep an eye on it and take it down to less than 180 probably.
And if you had to give us a choice of what you would use orally, provided the patient's got no intolerances?
If I'm using, so I would say for me, in acute settings like that, in that specific particular scenario, I'd probably use amlodipine. Of course, the thing is you have to watch the swallow. So the swallow, it will probably have gone in the acute stroke, won't it? So you're probably going to end up with IV anyway. But say in this circumstance, they had an NG in, then, you know, you could use amlodipine, just the normal sort of hypertensive guidelines that we would normally do.
And if they're on hypertensive treatment, you just carry that on. You just keep their normal meds going.
So, and that's even in the context of, you know, those other patients presenting where you have lowered the blood pressure deliberately, you know, bleeds. You want to get them off the IV treatment as soon as possible. So what we tend to do is, in that first 24 hours, is get the blood pressure down. But then beyond that, we should be then on the, you know, the next assessment by a consultant, thinking about an NG tube. If we can get an NG tube in, get some oral antihypertensives down, and then take off the infusion. So the infusion, you shouldn't have a circumstance where there's a stroke patient sitting on an infusion for days and days and days, really, ideally.
Okay.
I wanted to ask about adjuvant therapy or management, should we say. This is where I go a bit blank. I kind of remember when I was an SHO on a stroke ward, starting people on statins, is that still a thing? Do we still check lipids, HbA1c? What do we do?
So there is a very much like a, I suppose it's like a template, isn't it, when for all patients when they arrive? Because, and so how I explain it to patients is that there's three parts to stroke management. The first is it a stroke? Which is often the easiest bit. Then why did you have a stroke? Which takes a little bit of time, and then the recovery and prevention. Which come down the other end. So we start patients on secondary prevention fairly, fairly quickly. So you mentioned statins. Yes, so largely for all patients with ischemic stroke, we will offer lipid-lowering therapy. So we will start them on statin. I think the guideline is between 20 and 80 milligrams. So we choose 40. I think that's the reason. of atorvastatin. So, and that's sort of independent of their lipid profile. You want to get the lipid lowered to less than 4 total cholesterol and LDL less than 2. I think there's a new lipid guideline has just come out, which is a bit more complicated, but those are the arbitrary targets that we would aim for. That'd be the first thing, because statins, I often come to a bit of a moral dilemma with statins, because there's one side of me, which is the geriatric medicine trainee, and then the other side is the stroke trainee. And I think I've slightly moved a bit more towards the statin again, because statins have, there's the lipid lowering effect, which is of course the 10-year cardiovascular risk and whatever, but actually it has quite a lot of pleiotropic effects as well, such as plaque stabilization. So, you know, if you've had somebody who's had an artery-to-artery embolism, it may reduce the risk of recurrent stroke in the first few weeks. So actually it's there's a bit more to actually using the statin than just lowering the cholesterol. Sure. So we would offer it to all patients, or most patients, unless there's a contraindication. The other thing we would do with patients is, we've mentioned an ECG before, would be cardiac monitoring. I don't think we do that particularly well, and that's often due to bed pressures, but ideally they should be cardiac monitored for the first 24 hours. And what we're looking for is paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, but also when you have very severe strokes, there is a slight risk of arrhythmia, particularly bleeds, isn't there? So I know on the HASI we do have cardiac monitoring, and then often the patients are on labetalol or GTN, so they need that closer monitoring anyway. So, but I would, in feeling that, I would try and get an inpatient 24-hour ECG at some point during their admission. It shouldn't keep them in hospital. Like if they're well enough to go home, you could do as an outpatient, but if they're staying in, arrange it. We will check lipids as a baseline, LFTs, because we're starting on a statin, and I would also screen for diabetes as well. We tend to check a HbA1c. I don't know how validated that is as a screening tool. If there are any endocrine trainees listening, I apologize. But yeah, so we will consider diabetes and then obviously look at smoking history, alcohol history, all of that as well. If there is concern of a cardiac issue, so if you think it's a cardioembolic event, then we will arrange an echo. But I think echo is sometimes over-requested.
In life, in general.
In general, yeah.
99-year-olds, end-stage dementia. Yeah, exactly. We'll bring them back for an outpatient because their BNP was like,
off my soapbox. I know. And the waiting times are huge, aren't they? Yeah. But, you know, and I think we have to be sensible about who we're doing echoes on. You know, if you've got somebody with ischemic heart disease or any sort of heart disease, valvular heart disease, and you know, or an abnormal ECG, or another subset is a young patient, young stroke, which is a topical
in its own. Yeah.
But all young patients will get an echo. But those would be the times that, but yeah, we would. And then I suppose the last thing, which I think all of us gets forgotten, is DVLA guidance.
Yeah.
So telling patients that, you know, there's DVLA guidance that they should not drive for 28 days from the day of the event. And that's both TIA and stroke. They can just resume driving after 28 days if no further events, and they have made a good neurological recovery with no lasting severe impairment. And it doesn't clarify that as much for me. It doesn't clarify enough for me in what that means.
The other thing with DVLA guidance, I mean, I think probably maybe less so for stroke, but they change so often.
It does, yeah.
So it's always worth just having a look at the latest thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I tend to just search the document. There's like quite an interactive document you can use.
DVLA for medical professionals. Yeah. I've been on there a few times.
Because
I was really excited with myself because I did a talk on driving and I thought I knew everything. And then I realised 6 months later it was completely out of date. So I think it's a top tip to always just check. Can change. One other thing is patients who are type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. When I was having a quick flick through the NICE guidance, it mentioned it had a very odd phrase. It was something along the line of optimize, which can be achieved with intravenous insulin and glucose. So suggesting that you maybe put them on infusions. Yeah. What do you do?
I We should. I mean, this is the point of a HASU. So we talk about hyperacute stroke unit. Yeah. So by hyperacute, we mean within the first 48 to 72 hours of stroke. So what happens on a HASU, and I suppose I should say about stroke units, one of the best interventions you can do for a stroke patient is manage them on a stroke unit. That has been well evidenced. So I think that I can remember reading something somewhere. I mean, the number needed to treat for aspirin, I think it was something like 30. The number needed to treat for being managed on a stroke ward was 16 or 18. Right. So actually, it's better to manage them on a stroke unit than it is to actually do both. But it just goes to show. So because, and the reason that is the case is because you have people who, you know, nursing staff, full MDT, physiotherapist, occupational speech and language, everyone who is familiar with stroke, its rehabilitation, its complications. And in those first 48, 72 hours, the nursing staff are, it's a level two environment. So it's like, you know, it's better sort of nursing ratios because you have to keep a close eye on all parts of homeostasis. So the blood pressure needs frequent checks. The nursing staff are trained to do close to a neurological exam every whatever time according to their particular stroke neuro-obs.
They'll recognise when Peter's prescribed TEDS.
Absolutely. TEDS will be straight off.
But it is that sort of stuff. It's like the swallow start side. And I think if that number needed to treat, I don't know when that study was done, but it's probably worse now. Better for stroke units because we're now more de-skilled.
But it's true. And I think we were talking before this, weren't we, about, you know, for me, you know, a few years ago, I'd been in a DGH, brilliant at NIV. Now it's become so, you know, it's all within one service that anytime I have to get involved, now I'm scratching my head. Yeah. So
you get good at what you do. Right?
But sorry, to answer your question about the blood sugar. So the target blood sugars for patients with acute stroke is between 4 and 11. So yes, I think if patients have type 1 diabetes, I don't think we're as good as we probably should be. But I know blood sugar is monitored quite closely and we should be starting patients on BRIs or insulin infusions, whatever, according to local policy, whatever it is. Because the other thing, of course, with these patients is they're going to be ill by mouth, aren't they? Mm-hmm. So they're going to need that. And then what you're going to do is you're going to start an NG feed in the coming days. So then
sugar,
the blood sugars are going to go everywhere. So. Yeah.
Okay. Shall we move on and talk about thrombolysis in a bit more detail? Tell me about thrombolysis. Is there good evidence for it? When do we use
it? Yeah, so thrombolysis is, it's been quite a long time now, hasn't it? I can't even remember how long. But so for those of you who don't know, it is recombinant tissue plasminogen activator that we give. And the brand that we use here and at the moment is Altablaze. That'll probably change in the coming months and years, probably because Tenecteplase seems to be making an appearance, but at the moment it's Altablaze. So it is licensed for use within the first 4.5 hours of acute ischemic stroke. What we tend to do is often when a patient presents is we get an urgent CT brain done. If they have an onset time, i.e. within the 4.5 hours, if a bleed is excluded, and you have no other contraindications, of which there are many on a full list. We can add that as a show note. If you've gone down through all the contraindications and there aren't any, then you can offer Altablaze or thrombolysis. So the key things obviously are the most devastating risk is the risk of intracerebral hemorrhage, which we have to consent patients for. Sometimes it's difficult if they're unable to consent, but we would just always discuss it with family to get their assent, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I think the risk is probably somewhere in the region of 6%. So 6 in 100 chance of a severe intracerebral hemorrhage, which invariably would be fatal because it's not going to stop, is it? But there are other risks that we can, that come with it, you know, some local bleeding. So if they've had an ABG done when they came in, that's going to bleed. Mm-hmm. But that's fine because it's at a compressible site. other ones we might not be able to get to. So if they've had recent surgery, which is a contraindication, you can't easily get to that. Or what else?
I guess you're just making me think, though. I mean, things like ABGs. Don't do it on somebody who you might thrombolize.
Yeah.
In any situation,
Well, we literally... But I suppose, slightly out of stroke, with PEs...
You
think about it, probably all had ABGs.
Anything in medicine, it's being pragmatic. It's risk versus benefit.
Yeah.
Do you really need it? And if you do it, then, like you say, worst case scenario, that you can compress that.
That's it. You can compress. So it's compressed, but bleeding gums is another one you sometimes see as well.
So, I guess I was going to ask about, which we have slightly mentioned before we started recording, was about onset time, because the good question everybody always has there is about what if they wake up with a stroke?
Yeah.
And apparently that's changed.
It's all changed. It's all very exciting. It's all very busy stroke as a result. So historically it used to be you had to be within 4.5 hours of onset for reperfusion therapy, which at the time was largely thrombolysis. Then thrombectomy came along, and that was extended up to 6 hours, just for thrombectomy, not the thrombolysis. But we still had this problem where if patients woke up with their stroke, then they weren't eligible usually for thrombolysis or thrombectomy, because we didn't know when the onset was. So it could have been, they could have had their onset a minute before they woke up or a minute after they went to sleep 10 hours ago. So because we couldn't, we usually had to go by what we call last seen well. And sometimes we did, you know, a lot of detective work, ringing, you know, looking at their phone and seeing when was the last missed call, you know, and they're obviously on the phone and ring the person, were they okay?
Honestly,
it's the best people for it are the stroke specialist nurses.
Yeah.
They just know all the tricks.
It was playing Sudoku.
So... But it's now changed. So we have this, we have now got CT perfusion scanning. So basically patients come in with ischemic stroke, large vessel ischemic stroke. We'll all have three types of scans usually now. So they'll have an unenhanced CT head. That's largely just to exclude a bleed.
Yep.
Then they'll have a CT angiogram of the aortic arch and circle of Willis. And that's looking, is there a clot we can go in and pull out? And then they'll have a CT perfusion scan as well, which... It's very complicated. I'm still getting my head around it. It's lots of colours and things, but basically it allows us to see this physiological penumbra. So they talk about penumbra with stroke, which is area of brain tissue that is infarcting but salvageable. And then an ischemic core, and that's a bit that's dead. It will not, even if you restore blood supply, it will not, it won't heal. So the idea is if you've got a large penumbra, a small core, then we should go for reperfusion therapy. So, but if there's a large core, it usually suggests the stroke was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So it gives us that bit more, it basically has opened up huge opportunities for patients who otherwise would not have had reperfusion therapy. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's also aided by the fact that now in Mersey, we have a 24/7 thrombectomy service as well.
Yeah.
I think probably for the last 18 months. So it's very busy.
Yeah, exciting.
Very busy now.
So the way you choose, that was going to be one of our questions. It's basically based on that, isn't it? Can we see a big juicy clot that we can, and then presumably you have to speak to the thrombectomy team to see if they want to and if they think it's viable.
Yeah. So that's the thing, because thrombectomy is, at the end of the day, it's still an interventional procedure and it requires a general anaesthetic in most cases as well. So all of this has to be taken into consideration. And again, there's lots of things to consider with referrals. So, you know, it's their modified Rankin scale, your pre-stroke modified Rankin scale. So it used to be, I think, between 0 and 2, and it has to be, you'd be able to retrieve the clot, you know, so if it's way far on in the middle cerebral artery, you might not be able to get to it. And everybody's anatomy can be a little bit different as well. And then there are risks with it. I mean, you can have an intracerebral hemorrhage because of the subarachnoid hemorrhage, arterial dissection.
And what are the risks like compared to thrombolysis?
In terms of, so I think you would see, the thing is, we probably have the patients who go on for thrombectomy, a lot of them have been thrombolyzed as well.
Okay.
So that's You know, if you do bleed, you're going to bleed more, aren't you? Yeah. So you'll have a thrombolysis and you'll probably infusion still running, and then you'll go over and have thrombectomy as well.
Okay. So it's not like a one or the other.
No.
Like, because in my simple head, it's in MI.
Yeah.
You know, it went from thrombolysis
to the other,
to PCI. But in, you often thrombolyse them first.
Both, yeah. So the thing is, with a large vessel occlusion, so a large clot in, say, the M1 segment of the middle cerebral artery or ICA occlusion, thrombolysis probably isn't going to recanalize that, because if you think the autoplasm can only get to the part of the clot that it's at, and if it does, it's going to take a long time. So where thrombolysis probably helps in large vessel occlusions is opening up the collaterals.
Yeah.
Because if somebody's had an embolic event, there may be smaller thrombi that have gone with it, gone into the collaterals. So it opens up the collaterals, and that's where you see an improvement. And then you go in with thrombectomy and you get the big clot.
Okay.
So it's a bit of both. So it can be one, the other, or both. But there are other things, I mean, because it's a groin puncture as well. So we have had, I'd always say, I would expect that all patients who've had thrombectomy should come back to the HASU. But it is perceivable they could end up back in an MAU setting.
AMU,
apologies. Apologies. You talk about everything changing with your guidelines.
Very important.
You know, just you think you've got them right. But things to check for those patients are, check the pulses in the legs, check the wound site as well for hematoma expansion. We have had a case of an ischemic limb because of a thrombus that went down into the femoral as well. So, and then obviously close monitoring of GCS and things. But it's when it goes well, it goes really well. And I've seen patients who've presented with severely disabling strokes, and then by the following morning they've had an amazing recovery. They're the really rewarding ones. Yeah. You know, people who can't speak, and then the next day it's very minimal to nothing. When it's done early and quick.
I suppose I've got a quick question there. It's something I thought about a few days ago, and I was thinking about doing this podcast. So we often see those patients in the emergency department who've had a stroke, and their relatives are beside themselves because it's so upsetting.
Mm.
Is there any sort of information that we can give them in terms of, so let's take thrombolysis out of it, and let's say they're not for thrombolysis.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things do you say in terms of prognostication, like in terms of what sort of recovery can they expect? Or is it just too variable, you can't?
So, yeah, I mean, it's a common scenario, isn't it? You know, frequent questions, you know, are they going to die? What are they going to be like? Are they going to be in a nursing home and all of that? And it is quite variable, and it's quite difficult to predict. However, in terms of severity of the classes of strokes, we talked about TACs before.
Mm-hmm.
So TACs carries a 60% mortality,
mm-hmm.
and a very small number, I just can't remember offhand, of patients who would be independent at 1 year. So with TACs, I often say to families that it is likely that they're going to require a significant increase in the amount of care that they will need, or support that they will need on discharge. To what extent at this point, I can't say.
Yeah.
And then as you come down through the strokes, you know, so the other class, then a PAC, so partial anterior circulation stroke, that carries a much more favorable outcome in terms of functional improvement. And LAX carries the best, which is the Kuhner stroke, in terms of functional outcome as well. So, but I think patients, it's strange. It's strange how variable it can be into what patients perceive as really upsetting to them, what's important to them. Yeah. And I think that's where you come into trouble. So you can have a patient who has just got a very mild weakness to their dominant hand.
Yeah.
And they can become really upset and consumed with that.
Yeah.
And then you can have another patient then who has complete loss of that, but they've adapted quite well to use the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of have learned to cope with that. But the other thing I sort of liken to patients, or what I say to patients to try and, when they, you know, report things like this, it's a bit like a grieving process as well.
Yeah.
Because what you've lost with stroke is you've a new impairment you now have to adapt to. So that probably has impacts, and you can't do certain things you used to do. you have to do things a different way, or hobbies you can no longer do and you have to take up different hobbies. So it's a full life adjustment, isn't it? And that's why we've got, you know, within our stroke MDT, we have a clinical psychology service as well, which is brilliant. They really are brilliant to help patients with that. But it's so variable. So in that acute setting, often we say we'll just have to see how things go over the coming days and be guided. The other thing that slightly guides you is how well they recover in that first 2 weeks, you know.
Yeah.
If you're seeing a really fast recovery, well, that's quite promising.
Yeah.
If you're not seeing any improvement at all, that's a bit more concerning, isn't it? So, but of course, recovery for stroke is ongoing even beyond hospital, months and months and months and months. So it's time. That's the other thing I'll say. So we have to allow time and be patient, which can be hard. Yeah.
One final bit on this section for me, because I got a bit grumpy the other day, which I'm sure you can't imagine getting grumpy. But I think this is a while ago, and we had used to have a phone line service where GPs could ring through. And it was a patient who'd likely had a stroke a couple of days ago, but they were functionally able to do everything. So it was a bit of weakness in the left arm. So they came in, they had a CT scan, which confirmed that it was a sort of semi-acute, if you like, stroke. So it'd been recent, but it wasn't within the last few hours. And I wanted to ambulate them because they didn't need to be in hospital. And by the time I saw them, it was sort of 7 o'clock at night by the time they came in and had the CT and everything. And no, they have to be admitted because they have to see the stroke OT and physio. Go on, I got grumpy. So why do we have to admit somebody who's, you know, doesn't need bed? So present the other side and persuade me.
Yeah,
I'm wrong to be grumpy.
So was the patient fine?
Absolutely, totally mobile. They did still have, so it wasn't like a TIA. They did still have weakness. I think it was 4 out of 5.
Yeah.
But they could dress themselves. They could, you know, I was very proud of my inner geriatrician, you know. Buttons. They could do the buttons.
Yeah, that's the difficulty, isn't it? Because when patients have had an impairment from stroke, they then get assessed by the therapy teams, and we follow all our targets, which is our SNAP data, which is the Sentinel Stroke Audit. And there's certain targets for the time patients have to be seen by certain specialties and have certain things done and that. But the real reason, there's some reasons where we would admit patients for medical reasons, i.e. we need to do inpatient tests.
Yeah.
But I have seen, and it does tend to be very clinician dependent, you know, consultant dependent. If somebody has had a very minor stroke and they are functionally okay, then they can be ambulated generally. That's my view on it and view of
a few colleagues.
And I know a lot of stroke consultants that are of the same opinion as well, you know, because one of the biggest barriers to patients being discharged from stroke medicine or from a stroke ward is a rehabilitation, because that takes time. Barrier probably wasn't the right word. It's the part of their journey, I think, that takes the longest, because that does take time and you have to be safe to go home. But it sounds like with this patient, he was managing okay. The difficulty would be linking in with the therapy services.
And I think
the
that's
community.
The thing, isn't it? And then also you have to make sure that you haven't got any unconscious incompetencies. Like, I think that I know what I'm doing, that this patient doesn't need stroke, but have I properly assessed the swallow and things like that, I guess, is the other thing.
And I suppose that's the it's the follow-up as well, isn't it? Because obviously I suppose you'll want because what will happen will be is what I would normally do in that circumstance. It's difficult at 7 o'clock at night, but at say 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'll just ask the therapy team, ring them and say, can you come and see him now? Do you think he's okay to go home from your perspective? Do whatever urgent things we need to do. If you think a carotid Doppler needs doing or whatever, we'll do that and then get him home, because then they will follow him up then through their stroke follow-up pathway. 7 o'clock at night's a bit tough because there's not as many people around, is there?
They could maybe come back for that.
Maybe.
The future.
There's a lot of maybes.
Pete.
I don't think I've got any questions with regards to the ischemic stroke at the moment.
So, okay, TIAs, I suppose, as acute physicians, that might be something that we, well, not nowadays, but it was more our bread and butter, wasn't it, that we'd see TIAs. So I'll probably ask the same question that Peter asked earlier, which was What annoys you? Not in life, Brendan.
What annoys me?
Just with TIA management, or what do you think, you know, are top tips probably? It would be a nice way of asking the question.
What annoys me is I never see TIAs in TIA clinic. No, that's a bit of an over-exaggeration. But it's true, we see a lot of the mimics. Lot of mimics in TIA clinic.
If only there was a lovely way of remembering those mimics.
I know. Well, I do have a little mnemonic
really
for you. So all the S's. So we've got lots of S's. I mean, I think there was some originally, and I've added a few onto it over the as time's gone on. But, you know, there's so many things that can mimic a stroke. And I think we mimic a TIA. And I think sometimes TIA clinic is used as a rapid access, don't know clinic, which is okay, because if you don't know, the safe thing is to ask for help. But when it's quite clear in the first two sentences, you know, I stood up quickly, felt dizzy and fell over.
Stroke!
That becomes a bit frustrating.
Yeah.
Or most recently one, I took too much of my insulin. My wife came up and noticed I was slurring my speech. She checked my blood sugar and it was 2 and called an ambulance. She gave me Lucozade when the comet had gone away. So I admitted him to the stroke unit, as you can imagine. all of that.
Yeah.
So it's those things that I think get a bit frustrating. But that being said, sometimes there are, you know, these patients, you know, particularly if it is a TIA, TIA is really important to manage and to recognize early, because we can prevent strokes and we should be seeing all patients, strictly speaking, within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. We used to use ABCD2 scoring, which I still see going, but since 2019, NICE have said don't use it.
Yeah, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So
stop admitting to my weaknesses on podcasts, but I genuinely...
So I did know that, but yeah. I don't know what we're meant to use.
They should all be seen within 24 hours.
All of them.
Yeah.
So there we go. This is a TIA. See them tomorrow, please.
The problem is getting somebody into a TIA clinic within 24 hours. That's going to be the problem. So I think we've sort of kept it in some ways because we need to sort of prioritize of all of these urgent TIAs, who is the most urgent. Mm. So you sometimes hear it's still being used, but ideally best practice would be they all are seen the next day. But yeah, so we see lots of things in TIA. We see, you know, that mimic. So all the S's: seizure, sugar, hypoglycemia, space occupying lesion, thankfully rare-ish, sepsis, but we shouldn't see that in clinic, but it does mimic. So that's another bugbear of mine, a little bit out of TIA, but, you know, stroke alert, patients slurring their speech. Mm. When you get there, the systolic 60. Mm. Like, well, I would also be slurring my speech at a systolic of 60. So it's kind of like, you know, let's treat that first. Syncope can mimic medications.
But that doesn't begin with an S.
It doesn't, but I've said suspect medications. Some medications we like. And the suspects would be anticholinergics.
Okay.
Sedating medications, you know, benzodiazepines.
That does begin with an S.
It does actually. It should have changed that. Sedating medications maybe is better. I might amend that. Antihypertensives or... those sorts of glycosidase causing hyponatremia or hypoglycemia, all of those sorts of things.
And then my final
one, Saturday night. So drunk, drugs, probably are the main things I would say there. So it's important not to say we need to be open-minded about it. You know, oh, if they've got a history of alcohol excess, they're probably drunk. You need to be very careful with that, because they could actually be presenting with a stroke, couldn't they? I have had somebody drunk who's been having a stroke as well. So there's...
So unfair.
I know.
Luckily,
it could be much worse, couldn't it? And then all the things like cocaine causes strokes. It also causes bleeds.
And I think of mimics though. I also think of migraine.
Migraine.
But that doesn't begin with an S.
It doesn't. So I had to put it down in a separate section.
I'll work on it for you. Yeah. Get an S out there.
So migraine, absolutely. So migraine, I think migraine is really interesting because I'm trying to sometimes explain to a patient that the symptoms they've got as a migraine can be quite challenging. You know, how have I got a migraine with tingling to my arm? You know, so I often explain it's a spectrum. You know, it can be anywhere from you know, just visual aura, you know, like ocular migraine, for example, to hemiplegic migraine and all in between, you know, vestibular migraine. So migraine, I think we see very commonly, particularly, you know, things that might give you a clue to that. There's a history of migraines. They have a headache. They have the other features that are classical, you know, mild photophobia, nausea, impedes their daily activity. They have to go and lie down and wait till it passes. Syncope, vasovagal syncope is quite common to see, but we mentioned that before. Mm-hmm. Anxiety actually is quite a common thing as well. So quite debilitating for patients, because the somatic symptoms that can come with anxiety can be quite distressing and quite alarming, and can mimic stroke, mimic heart attack as well. And I think it's, you have to be sympathetic towards that as well. You know, you can get tingling in the hands, around the lips, mm. you can get slurred speech, all of those sorts of things. So,
and I think, because I've been or listening to, that was a good talk on patients who are having sort of those sort of symptoms where it's not pathological, and actually just dismissing them have really bad outcomes. And there's lots of work in the neurology, sort of with the,
it's the functional neurological disorders.
And they actually do much better if with proper
reviews.
But it's time, isn't it? And but unfortunately, a lot of these patients will just get.
And do you know what? The thing about functional neurological disorder, it's, again, reasonably common. I think we have to have a very, we have to keep a very open mind about them. It's very tempting sometimes. You'll sometimes hear people use behavioral and functional interchangeably, which isn't true. And the thing about functional neuro, you need to sort of be making a positive diagnosis of it, and then an MDT treatment. So there's actually locally here, I know we do have a service, a dedicated service at the Walton Centre for functional neurological disorders, which is an MDT approach. Yeah, they can make really good recovery early on, you know, if it's early. And then, of course, demyelination would be the other thing to consider as well.
So it doesn't begin.
It doesn't.
I mean, I'm thinking special headache.
Special headache.
It starts getting so easy. I think, looking at the time, sadly, that we should wrap up. I'll let our listeners into a secret that we were thinking. We might have to split this podcast into two because we'll talk so much. We haven't even got to the part we're thinking about part two. So we will, I think, have part two, and that is going to be discussing posterior stroke, because I think that is a podcast on its own. So we will look forward to doing that. So before we wrap up, normally we sort of like summarize or do our top things, but I mean, literally everything was a clinical pearl.
Yeah,
that was brilliant. It was so timely as well for me, with seeing more and more stroke patients on the AMU. But Peter, if you could pick your top three tips or facts, what would you say?
So I shouldn't be prescribing TEDS.
Okay, brilliant. I think we can leave it there.
Job done. Job done. Sugars, I never think about sugars with a stroke as well. I've never thought about even looking at the BMs. And thrombolysis and thrombectomy, I suppose. I didn't realise, I've never been involved with anyone having thrombectomy, only thrombolysis. And so I didn't know anything about thrombectomy, to be quite honest. So that was quite an eye-opener as well. In fact, I think you can have both as well.
So I think for my top three was the aspirin 300 until the day of discharge, because often those now patients are on our ward and going home.
Yeah.
And I would correct the TTO, so I won't anymore. not that I have, but it's a good timely reminder. The number needed to treat the stroke units, 16 to 18.
I need to get the exact numbers again, don't I?
We'll put it in the show notes. Or 30 versus 30 in aspirin. I thought that was really interesting. And then also, I think it is perfectly possible that a patient post-thrombectomy may come back to our ward. Look at the legs. I mean, I do like looking at legs in patients anyway. I don't know why. I feel like it's a representation of how they're doing. Nice, warm, well perfused. We're doing all right. There's no big edema there. There's no clinical DVT hiding under the sheets. But yeah, that's a top tip. That's been fab, and I'm really looking forward to part two. Thank you, Brendan.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to another episode of the Society for Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website at www.acutemedicine.org.uk for all things acute medicine. including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You will also find more info about Acute Medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @AcuteMedPod and let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd love to see us explore in future episodes, or if you'd like to just get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time.